Very good. But now it's time to invite Professor Jackson on stage. Tim Jackson is the author of the groundbreaking report produced by the Sustainable Development Commission of the UK called Prosperity Without Growth, the Transition to a Sustainable Economy. Actually, this document can also be downloaded from the internet, and I understand that now it will also be translated and published in Finnish by next summer. Professor Jackson, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Please don't say that thing about free downloads when my publisher's standing in the room. Growth, degrowth, décroissance, what's his in language? I apologize to you that I can't speak to you yet in Finnish. I'll practice for the book launch. There is some sense, I think, in which words and language matter. I was in the Netherlands and Flanders for a Dutch translation of Prosperity Without Growth. I don't know if you any Dutch speakers here, but it translates, and I had some trouble with this, the title of my own book, Welvaart zonder Groei. And it was particularly the Groei word that I had some trouble with, and then someone gave me a little tip. They said, think of it like you're about to spit. Groei. And that seems to me, a nice way to describe and to think about growth. And by contrast, I think, if I can just make a comment on the language of degrowth, personally, I just find the French much more appetizing. Décroissance. It sounds like something you would want for breakfast. No wonder that Serge Latouche has written 20 books about it. So I would urge the degrowth movement to think very carefully about language. More seriously, I want to explore the dimensions of growth and degrowth, and to set out some of the arguments in what, as was already mentioned, started its life as a report to the UK government. Very quickly became the fastest downloading report that we'd ever produced, and then has another life in an expanded version as a book, which is what will be translated into Finnish. And I want to just spend a little bit of time running through the arguments in the book. I'm just looking for time here so that I know how much time I've got. Have I got about half an hour? Is that roughly? Okay, I'll aim for that, and you can stop me if I go too far. And I want to really just sketch for you the arguments in the book, and they revolve around three main things. One is something which I call the dilemma of growth. And I think this is something that the degrowth movement needs to take as seriously as the growth movement needs to take it. And I will explore that dilemma. I will talk about our responses to it, and on the understanding that our responses to the dilemma are insufficient, I want to then explore the dynamics of this economic and social system just a little bit to see whether it is the kind of system that is amenable to change in any meaningful respect. And I think it is only through exploring that dynamic that it's possible then to construct, and this is the third part of the arguments in the book, to construct avenues for change, to construct opportunities where policy initiatives could make a real difference to how economy works, how society works, and to the quality of our lives. So those are the three parts. I will go quite quickly through the dilemma of growth because it's very familiar, at least some of the elements of it are familiar to you, and others have already been sketched very nicely by Peter. So here we go with the dilemma of growth. The first horn of this dilemma is particularly well known to you, and it's just this. I'm just going to say it. Growth is unsustainable. Growth, certainly in the form that we've had it, is unsustainable. And I will show you, as Peter did, this wonderful illustration of the fact that we are already in ecological overshoot in certain key respects. And so when you ask yourself the question, how can we consider an economy that will have grown between 16 and 40 times by the end of this century. How can the finite planet sustain that level of economic growth if we are already in this position of overshoot? So I barely need to say that in this audience. What I perhaps do need to sketch a little bit more clearly is the arguments around the second horn of the dilemma, that degrowth, décroissance, whichever language you say it in and prefer to say it in the existing system at least, is unstable, and you don't really have to look any further than the evidence of the most recent financial crisis and recession to see the visceral fear that enters the faces of policymakers in the face even of a slowing down of economic growth. And it seems to me that this then becomes a very real dilemma. It's not a simple place. We can't simply collapse where we are in relation to the growth-based economy and expect the transition to be manageable. Neither can we expect to go on as we were. This is a profound place to find ourselves after 200 years of industrial development, 50 years of the pursuit of economic growth, and at a point in time when the population and resource use are expanding massively. So this, I think, is what I want to emphasize, first of all, that we have to take this dilemma seriously, and we have to take as seriously the instability generated by the degrowth within the existing system as we do the unsustainability of growth within that system. And I want to unpack that instability a little bit further. Peter pointed to one of the factors in that instability, which is the continual pursuit in the capitalist economy of labor productivity. And if I can do more, labor productivity means I can do more next year with the same number of people I employed this year. If the economy doesn't grow, conversely, then I'm putting people out of work. So the long-term trend, the pursuit of labor productivity, relies on growth if we assume that people are going to continue to work and to remain employment at the same level. One of the ways to respond when the recession hits, of course, is for governments to stimulate spending. We saw exactly that. We saw quite fast rises in public sector debt. And this is a second structural factor in the instability of degrowth. Governments are only able to do that, to protect jobs by investing public money in stimulating the economy, if they expand the public debt, and they can only service that debt in relation to future expectations of returns to the government from a growing economy. So the structure of debt becomes another of the issues in the instability with which degrowth confronts us. And then there is clearly a point, Peter alluded to it very briefly, around the distinction between a financial sector and the real economy, as it's called by economists. And this has been another mechanism for expanding growth of the real economy, has been to change the structure of money. Monetarism, monetary expansion, was the means chosen in the early 1990s to keep consumption growth going, particularly in the richest economies, when it looked like it might stagnate and when public sector debt was no longer available or no longer politically acceptable to stimulate further consumption growth. And what we saw, I think, in the financial crisis was the limits of that strategy. So I should also say, to some extent, that the growth-based model itself has instabilities within it. But on the other hand, this system of creation of money, over 95% of money is created by debt in private institutions, actually locks us into a growth-based model to create the productive assets that will pay off that debt and complete the circle in which money is made and continually generated in the economy. So this structure of money, the creation of money, becomes a critical issue. And then finally, of course, underlying this, the dynamic of the pursuit of profit, the profit motive itself, and the way that it plays into competition in particular between firms, between individuals, and in the pursuit of largely private interests creates a an underlying dynamic that we have to examine as a part of the architecture of the growth-based economy. But then suddenly, when you look at this list of four things, you realize these are defining parameters of what? Of a growth-based economy. So here's the simple way of summarizing it. Degrowth is unstable in a growth-based economy. It's not that degrowth is unstable in its own sake. It's not that the idea of living more simply is impossible in some kind of economic system, but it clearly is very challenging in what is structurally a growth-based economy. So what is our answer to this? What is the answer of politicians to this profound dilemma? Peter alluded to it, and it's a very important distinction to make. It's the distinction between material growth and economic growth, or conversely, between material degrowth and economic degrowth. And there has been, as many of you will know, quite an argument within the degrowth community which of those two things we're referring to. And the existence of that argument actually is the wiggle room, what we call the wiggle room, the space where actually the political response to the unsustainability of growth is to call for a dematerialization of economic value, of economic output, to decouple economic growth, which can continue to rise. We hope the dollar value can go up and up, and we can do things more efficiently, and we're good at doing things more efficiently, aren't we? Because we're a capitalist economy, and by doing so, we will reduce our material growth, even degrow materially. So we can do this. We can get this lovely separation between economic value and material growth. And this idea of dematerializing economic value is a very useful and very important one. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, can we actually remotely deliver what's necessary in terms of sustainability? And again, if you look historically, and Peter showed you similar graphs, it doesn't take very long to understand that we have done nothing like that in the last 50 years. This actually is a graph just of the period between 1990 and 2007. You'll remember perhaps that 1990 was the base year chosen by the Kyoto Protocol. And if you look at the graph, the line that represents the carbon dioxide emissions, it's the red one in the graph, what you'll see is that that carbon dioxide emissions rose 40% over that period, which wasn't quite what the Kyoto Protocol had in mind, I suspect, in trying to curb carbon emissions. It's an evidence amongst all sorts of evidence, in fact, that we're going in the wrong direction. And you could argue, of course, that we didn't try hard enough. You could try and save this idea of decoupling by saying, let's try harder. And then you have to ask yourself how hard we need to try. And here's a little exercise in which I've done that. It's an imaginary world, a hypothetical world. It has 9 billion people in it, which is the mid-range expectation for 2050. And we're going to give those 9 billion people, unusually, of course, the right to a Western European-level income, expanding at 2% per year. We believe in growth. We believe in equality. We think it's right to raise the poorest nations, perhaps even to the levels of Western European incomes. And at the same time, we want to meet our carbon targets in that year. And so my question, it's a very simple one, quite a legitimate one, I think, is how far and how fast would we have to run in order to achieve that? And it's illustrated by this graph. This is a graph of the carbon intensity of economic output, the CO2 per dollar. And here is where we are on the left-hand side at the moment. And in my hypothetical world, 9 billion people aspiring to Western incomes with growth and meeting carbon targets, this is where we need to be, right over on the right-hand side. It's a 130-fold improvement, and that is 10 times faster and further than anything we've achieved in industrial history. And then if you want growth to continue, you have to push that number down further, and by the end of the century, actually, you're in a situation where CO2 per dollar is less than zero, whatever that means. It means, actually, an economy that's pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And even though this is the inevitable logical conclusion of some quite basic assumptions that we hold dear. There is no politician anywhere who can answer the question what that economy looks like, what its resource base is, what its production services are like, what kind of goods and services people consume, what life is like in an economy which is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. So this is just an illustration, really, that what we have in our minds at the moment to save ourselves from the dilemma of growth is a kind of magical realism. It's a heroic assumptions about our own cleverness in delivering us from this dilemma. And to my mind, you could perhaps say, this is a huge challenge, let's just get on with it. You could look at this graph and say, let's do it. And that may be one way to motivate people, but at the very least, I think we need to ask ourselves the question, is this kind of transformation possible? Is the system, the structure of the economic system, capable of delivering transformation on this scale? And this is where I move to the second set of arguments, which is around not just economic but social structure. And I think it's very important to take these seriously, because it is these dynamics with which we have to work. This is the kind of society that we have. So let me just sketch that out for you briefly. The first bit of it, very, very simple 5-minute run through economics 101. Firms produce goods for households. Peter showed you a version of this and provide us with incomes which we can then spend on more goods and services. That's called the circular flow of the economy, much beloved by economists. I want to point to one key feature of this, which is something I'll come back to. It's the role of investment. And investment is used. One of the key uses of investment is to chase productivity, that labor productivity that matters so much. And in some ways, that's good, because what it does is it brings down the prices of goods. Noticeably, when the price comes down, it also encourages us to buy more things. So almost immediately, this circular flow has a dynamic that pushes us towards the expansion of demand. But I want to draw your attention to another very specific element in this, the structure of the way that investment is used. Joseph Schumpeter, an economist in writing in the middle of the last century, pointed to a process of what he called creative destruction. Investment is used continually in a process of throwing over the old in favor of the new. Old processes in favor of new processes. Old products in favor of new products. Continual chasing of new consumer markets, the expansion of consumer novelty. And this is where the story gets even more interesting, because it turns out that human beings have something of an appetite for novelty. We like new stuff, the latest gadget, the fastest car, the biggest house, the best holiday in the sun. We use novelty in all sorts of ways to signal status competition, to tell ourselves stories of hope about the future. The world is a brighter, newer, shinier place tomorrow than it is today, for my children than it is for me. And actually, this pursuit of novelty creates a kind of social logic, and all of a sudden we find ourselves locked into a combination of economic structure driven by the production of novelty and social structure driven by the consumption of novelty that looks a much more intractable terrain. It's an odd system. I mean, it's a system driven in some sense by anxiety. The anxiety of the firm is to keep ahead of the competition in the pursuit of expanding consumer markets. The anxiety of us, of people, is something Adam Smith referred to as the desire to live a life without shame. A very basic humanizing desire, in fact. In Adam Smith's day, it was his example of what you needed to live a life without shame was a linen shirt. In our day, it's a hybrid car, an HD TV, an iPhone, an iPad, 2 holidays a year in the sun. The list goes on. And even if we don't actually want these things, the system needs us to buy them, because if we don't, it begins to collapse. And it's exactly why we expanded the money supply. We expanded credit and debt to persuade people to keep on buying. Here is how that expansion looked just before the crisis in the United Kingdom. It's different in each country, I know that. But this is particularly clear because it shows a massive rise in personal consumer debt until it was above the GDP for 3 years in a row, and a complete collapse in household savings. People drawing down their future security, expanding their debt as fast as they could just so they could stay in the game. And this is, just to put it in very, very simple terms, this is a really strange story. It's a story about us, about people being persuaded or encouraged to spend money they don't have on things they don't need, to create impressions that won't last on people they don't care about. And it is, when you understand it in this perversity, is a place that is ripe for change, but it is also a place where we should not and cannot underestimate the complexity, the social and economic complexity of the system that we're dealing with. So where do we go from here? This is my third and final section of arguments. How do we generate change here? How do we even see where change is possible? And I think one of the ways to see where change is possible is immediately to ask questions. Is this model of who we are actually the correct one? Is this vision of ourselves as narrow, selfish, materialist consumers an appropriate one to reflect the human condition? And almost immediately, actually, even within the very narrow knowledge of economics, we find anomalies. The first anomaly was that this savings rate, which had plummeted below zero, turned upwards in the recession. And this is something that happens in a recession. People want to save. They want to consider future security. They want to concentrate on necessities rather than luxuries. But paradoxically, this is exactly the wrong thing to do according to economics. In fact, Keynes called this the paradox of thrift. If you save during a recession, you slow down the recovery, and that's exactly why politicians everywhere were encouraging people to go out and spend to get us out of the mess. But what I want to point out here is all of a sudden we're not looking at a system in which our own inclinations, our own desires are in tune with the way the system works. We're actually looking at a system that is at odds with our own nature. And actually, if you expand this argument further and you look for social psychology, or you look through philosophy, or you look through the wisdom traditions to find out who we are as human beings, you find a much, much broader picture than the one at the heart of the economic model. And I want to speak a little bit about that because it points to, I think, a very key avenue for institutional change. Social psychology talks about selfishness in human beings. Of course it does. But it situates that in the context of a tension between self-serving behaviors and other-regarding behaviors, between selfishness and altruism, if you like. And equally, it points to a tension between novelty-seeking behaviors and conservation or traditional behaviors. And this, the psychology that leads to this has actually evolutionary basis. It suggests that these features of our psyche are adaptive because of the way that we evolve. Selfish behaviors work in certain conditions like flight or fight, but other regarding behaviors, social behaviors, were essential to our evolution as social beings. Likewise, novelty seeking works well in adaptive, when fast changing circumstances, it's adaptive, but actually conservation and tradition is the only way to lay down the stability that allowed us to evolve in social groups and to bring up our children. Basic evolutionary functions were laid down not just in that narrow quadrant of novelty selfish behaviors, but actually across a much broader spectrum. And when you look at it in this light, you see what we've done. We've systematically encouraged and incentivized those novelty-seeking behaviors because they're what we need to keep the system going. And in the same token, we've excluded the depth and the breadth of the human soul. And of course, if you wanted solutions, perhaps we should seek those solutions in expanding that idea of what it means to be human, not curtailing possibilities, in fact, but allowing ourselves the freedom to become fully human and to develop the institutions that protect what is most fragile within us, Rembrandt's lovely altruist within. So here is a possibility of a different sense of ourselves. It needs a different sense of what prosperity itself might mean, and that's a task which I undertook in the book. I like this particular definition. Prosperity is about our ability to flourish fully as human beings. And of course that has material elements, but it also has really important social and psychological elements, identity, meaning, participation in society. These are the elements of flourishing. These are the elements of a lasting prosperity. And our task, if you like, is to create the means to flourish in these ways in less materialistic terms. One very, very simple example I like to use: if participation is what matters, then space matters, the space between us, the spaces where we can connect, where we can participate. And so public goods, public spaces are an important component of that. They are what Michael Sandel called sites for the cultivation of a common citizenship: museums, libraries, concert halls, leisure centres, community halls, green spaces, parks, places of joy and celebration, places of contemplation and tranquility. These are the sites where it's possible for us to connect with each other, to participate in less materialistic ways. And though I don't need you to accept that this is the prominent route towards a material degrowth, all I want to say is that here is a very, very concrete avenue for change, reconceiving the simplicity and the longevity of public space. That doesn't solve, of course, the economics. So finally, I want to come back to the clues that we have in relation to reconstructing economics. And the basis of this is really to ask the question, what would economics look like if we stretched the model of human nature at its heart along those two axes, selfish versus altruistic, novelty versus tradition? What would its institutions look like? How we would reconceive the structures that creates the macroeconomy? How would we invest? What would investment look like? What would enterprise look like? And those three components are, I think, the fundamental basis of a different economy, a different economics. So a concept, I pointed out how important investment was. I want to highlight something which I've called ecological investment, something which I call ecological enterprise, a different vision of enterprise. And what's clear is that we also need and do not have, apart from the groundbreaking work of people like Peter Victor, we do not have a macroeconomics that allows for economic stability in a way that doesn't require consumption growth. That is an urgent task. It's an intellectual task, it's a policy task, it's a task that demands attention and resources to create. But let me lead you very quickly through these different elements. Ecological investment, how would this differ? Investment, actually, at the end of the day, is just a relationship. It's the primary economic relationship between the present and the future. And it's a relationship that we have given over to short-term, high-risk, high-payback, we hope, investment in unsustainable resources. And what we need, in fact, to do is to recreate the concept of investment itself as being the foundation for a transition to a low-carbon economy, the protection of our ecological assets, the building of social goods, and the protection of decent livelihoods. This is a new portfolio for the investment markets, but we can't expect it to be delivered by the existing financial sector. Some of these investments will have good returns, good paybacks, but others of them you'll have to think about much longer periods of return and perhaps lower rates of return, and some of them won't show conventional financial returns at all. We will have to measure their success in terms of social and ecological returns. So we need new measurements of what return means, new structures for how investment works, new vehicles and legal forms to allow people to use that propensity to save and to invest in their own security in ways that benefit them and benefit their communities. And one of the things that means is that we need different forms of enterprise. We need different structure for enterprise. So let me talk a little bit about that idea. There's been a lot of talk about the transition from a goods-based economy to a service-based economy. And in principle, if we could do that, that would be a fantastic thing, because it is the services that we exchange with one another that add economic value, that add social value to our lives. And you can think about an economy based around providing services, around building real capabilities in health, in education, in social care, in leisure, in community recreation, in the renovation of buildings, in the regeneration of cities, a whole range of new enterprises. And these enterprises have the potential, at least, to tread more lightly on the planet. Here is a concept of ecological enterprise. It could actually provide jobs at the local level. It could draw employment into it. It could support the resilience of communities. There is only one problem with this, and it's similar to the problem with ecological investment. It doesn't necessarily give you back growth. It employs people. It provides valuable services. But it's actually almost a pariah in the conventional economy. If you look at this data, this is just data on the productivity of different sectors. Economists are completely obsessed with the idea of productivity and productivity growth. But the difficulty is, if you identify this sector I've talked about, it exists in the formal literature only as personal and social services. And the productivity growth, in the words of the dismal science, over 20 years was dismal. In fact, in many cases, it was negative. This is a sector that actually drags down the formal economy in conventional terms. Why does it do that? Well, actually, because the value inherent in these services is the labor content of them. Does it make any sense to ask your doctor to see more and more patients every year, or your teachers to teach bigger classes, or your social care workers to be seeing more and more people in their day's work? Where is the quality of these goods? It invested in the time that people put into them. So the chasing of labor productivity in these sectors makes no sense whatsoever. And yet they offer us these sectors. This concept of ecological investment, this concept of ecological enterprise, offers us the basis for a different kind, a different structure of economy that would protect people's jobs and retain economic stability. Here's just a little example. I like this one because you can go home and do it. Change your search engine from Google to Ecosia. Ecosia works just the same, its revenue model is just the same, but it gives 80% of those revenues to a rainforest protection project in the Amazon. It's just a very, very simple example of a different kind of enterprise. Its aims are the protection of ecological assets. It's written into the Constitution that this is where its surpluses are to be distributed. And actually a rise now in the UK of community interest companies around this same idea, that the basis of the company is not the pursuit of private profit, but the interest of the community. New legal forms provide the basis for this transition. I want finally then just to sum up, if you like, with a different kind of circular flow. It's not dissimilar to the ideas that Peter was putting forward, but it is put some of the blocks that I've talked about in a strategic place. Ecological enterprises provide the capabilities for people to flourish and to participate in the construction of society. Participation really does matter. And the outcome of that is improved flourishing. But it only ever occurs within the context of a finite planet in which ecosystems provide the invaluable resources that we need to create any kind of economic activity. Peter pointed out that very clearly. We've begun in, for example, the Teeb project, which reported twice this summer, to put some economic values on those services. And while I would not argue that just putting economic values is all we need to do, I think what was striking about that report was the fact that the monetary value attributable to economic service is not a trivial adjustment to the global economy. It is actually, even in the eyes of these very well-established conventional economists, equivalent to, it's of the same order of magnitude as the commercial economic flows. And that's a profound place to be, because it suggests that we're not in the business of tinkering at the edges of the economy to bring ecosystem assets into the picture. We are actually looking at system transformation to achieve it. And the one thing I think that's been left out of this dialogue so far is that we have to repay that favor. The bounty of nature is not something that will forever be available to us. It is something that we have to think about investing in, protecting, maintaining for future generations. Here's the beginnings, if you like, of an ecological macroeconomics. There is so much work to be done. It is so encouraging to see so many people here engaged in that task. And the appetite for this conversation is now huge. But the elements of it, to some extent, in conceptual terms, we already have a very, very good basis for. I started, it was mentioned that the report was originally to government. Government likes to know what to do on Monday. And I couldn't have got away without a whole chapter that talks about what they could do, actually, even on Friday afternoon, if they really put their minds to it. And there's quite a lot that we could talk about there, but I did also boil that down to simplify it into just three main points, really. One is to establish the limits, because we are living within those limits, and we need to know how that changes our economic structure, what's possible within those limits. Fix the economics, because for goodness sake, even in their own terms, they are broken, and change the social logic. What could possibly be simpler than that? It is, of course, a lot more complicated. There's lots more to be said about it, but I'll just leave you with this quote from President Sarkozy. Towards the end of last year, he launched the Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance and Social Progress, and he said, the crisis doesn't only make us free to imagine other models, another future, another world, it obliges us to do so. And whatever Carla Bruni thought of him imagining other models, we don't know, but what we do know is that there is a very, very strong point here about sustainability and about responsibility. This is a unique opportunity. It is a conversation for our times, and I heartily welcome the interest that you are all showing in that conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Jackson. Tim, in your book on prosperity without growth, you pointed out that humans can flourish while consuming less. And also in your work, you have raised the issue of and the myth of decoupling. But in your presentation today, there was one element missing, and I know that you have also studied that one. It's regarding fiscal revenue. So I would like to first ask whether in our current societies that are based on the market economy, and growth basically is a must if we want to continue with the current system, how do you think that fiscal revenue can be ensured, taking into account that actually our societies are aging, and actually the need for public funding is increasing?
In a sense, I did refer to that, because it is my own sense that much of this is how importance of this and how we respond to this is how we structure investments. And it does seem to be absolutely key that we create the vehicles for the saving mechanisms that will allow us to fund pensions, that will allow us to provide health, that will allow us to provide social security. But we also, and these were things that I didn't particularly mention, we also need to think quite cleverly about fiscal restructuring. We assume that the role of government is to levy taxes on people's incomes in order to provide services, but there are other ways of levying taxes, for example, on the damaging things that we want to get rid of. And there are other ways of levying revenues for government, for example, around, and these are ideas that have some currency, around user charging. In fact, who owns the productive assets and who generates surpluses from them is a very, very key question again. And the assumption has been that private interests own the means of production and have the prerogative over the surpluses from them, and that government underwrites the risk of that, as we saw during the financial crisis. I think that has to be revisited. I think we have to look at actually the potential for different forms of ownership. Some of them will be public ownership, and that some of the revenues from that will actually provide for the services that we want in terms of health, pension, social security in the future. This, again, is a huge task. It's a task that should involve us not just in the microeconomics of response and elasticity to taxes, but actually in the structure of the institutions of the state, of community government, of private interests, and of these new entrepreneurial forms that I've suggested we need to make the transition.